Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And we are live. Hello to the wonderful Sue Fleece.
Hi, how are you, Mel?
Well, you know, you've been keeping me busy all week. You are like over 50 children's books. You're trying to set some kind of world record here. And this is bound to keep interviewers busy. And it's a good because it takes my mind off of the war here. So thank you very much for occupying my
Thank
time.
You. I joke with another author sometimes when we have books coming out. I always say, maybe this will be my breakout book. And I said, how many books do I have to write before I have the breakout book? A joke. My books have done well. I'm not complaining. But
you've sold almost a million books, dear. I don't know if I've interviewed anyone who sold that many books, but I mean, perhaps I don't know. It's a possibility. But anyway, so I have to introduce the show. So I'm Mary Rosenberg, and I am the host of the Children's Literature Channel of the New Books Network. And I'm here with the mega, mega, mega writing star, Sue Fleece. And it's wonderful to have you on the show. And we were e-introduced by your agent, yes. Jennifer Unter. So thank you very much, Jennifer, for introducing us. And you keep Jennifer busy.
I do. You know, I met Jennifer in, I think it was 2009, and I was querying agents, and I had talked to an editor that had recently left her publishing house, and I asked this editor, you know, who are some of your favorite agents that you've worked with? And Jennifer's name came up, and also Jennifer happened to have just left a bigger agency and she was starting her own agency. So the timing was really good. And at that point I had probably written about 6 or 7 manuscripts that were not, you know, sold or anything. And I had one sort of interest in one. And anyway, I queried her and it was a match and I've been with her ever since. So yes. I mean, we had a couple of pockets of time where we're like, gosh, are we going to sell anything? And then it just kind of exploded. And I always remember when I was sort of down in the dumps about it and Jennifer said, we're sowing the seeds. And I thought, okay, I just need to keep the faith that something's going to click soon with these editors. And I think I don't know, 7 years or so, I've had multiple books come out every year. So yes, I keep her busy. I almost feel bad about it, but then I don't feel bad about it because then we're both doing well, right?
So how wonderful to be interviewing you. And of course, you are the one in a million authors that...
that's so nice.
...that have done so well. And we want to know what your pixie dust or your leprechaun dust is. We're going to find out today. So we're celebrating. You have like 3 or 4 books coming out with the next few months. And I've interviewed almost 200 authors. And I've never interviewed an author that has 2 books coming out the same month, practically, with the same publisher. And then another one coming out with Sky Pony. It's crazy. So
it's a little crazy.
Does Albert Withman know that they're publishing 2 of your books within a month of each other?
I think so. I mean, I think it's small enough that it's not, this hand doesn't know what this hand's doing. But one of the books that is coming out in April is part of a series, so I think that's more scheduled. And then I have a Fractured Fairy Tale, so I'll show you the books that I have. So this one just came out last week, Octopus Acrobatics.
This is the one we're celebrating.
I know, I'm so excited. I'll talk about this in a minute because I could talk about octopuses the whole entire time, so I don't want to do that. But so this one was a companion book to this one that came out last year, Cicada Symphony, all both illustrated by Gareth Lucas. He outdid himself. But the one that's the series that comes out in April, this is still the advanced reading copy, but this is part of the Kid Scientist series, Zoologists on a Trail, and the kids go to Yellowstone Park and they're following a pack of wolves. They're trying to make sure that either the wolves have are healthy, if they've grown in number, and they use something really cool called bioacoustics to do this instead of the wolf collar. So that's kind of cool. And then the Fractured Fairy Tale that comes out on the same day in April is Beauty and the Beaker, also illustrated by an amazing illustrator in Greece named Petros Boulibasis. Sorry, the Kid Scientist series is illustrated by Mia Powell. I can't, there it is. And so Petros has done all of my Fractured Fairy Tales, which started with Mary Had a Little Lab. But this one is about a girl who lives on an island, and the power keeps going out because of all the storms that happen. The storm is the beast. And she creates a green energy with, she creates a biofuel through her collection of algae. She tests a bunch of substances and then, sees that the algae is the key to that. And the other one that comes out in May is with Sky Pony Press. It's part of my Magical Creatures and Crafts series. It's called How to Train a Tooth Fairy. I don't have anything physical to show you, but it's a cute cover, and the kids are worried because it's the Tooth Fairy's sort of first day on the job, and they're worried she might not find their house and find the right tooth and figure out who's lost the tooth. So they make signs and kind of directions for her to help train her, so that she can be successful. So yes, sometimes I am overwhelmed at even trying to tell people about the books that I have coming out because I feel like it's rapid fire and I'm just talking about myself all the time. So thank you for helping to spread the word so that I don't always feel like I'm, out there saying, look at me, I have another book. But yeah, so that's kind of that's what I have going on this year. And it does feel like a lot sometimes, but it's, of course, it's a champagne problems, right?
Exactly. So let's talk about the octopus book for a few minutes, and then we'll talk about your career and your success.
Do you want me to just talk about the octopus book? I don't know if you had a question or if I should just.
Well, Sue, you wrote it. I mean, I read it, but.
I will say the one thing that I think is so cool is that the cover is sort of this wraparound cover, and I just think it really pops. And when I first saw the cover, I thought, oh my gosh, that's the perfect cover. I Gareth Lucas just outdid himself. I don't know how he just
It's a gorgeous book.
the colors that
Some
he
people are
used.
listening on podcast. So for those people, just run out and buy this beautiful book.
Oh yeah, sorry, you can't see it right now.
And
That's all.
I don't, Sue, I don't want to tell people to buy all of your books because they'll go bankrupt, but buy a few of them. They're
Well,
gorgeous.
also you can tell them a lot of libraries have my books, so they can buy a couple if they want to, and then they can go check them out at the library, right?
There you go.
Yeah,
By the way, some of your books also have videos.
yes.
And your video on how to what's it how to trap a leprechaun
Oh
has almost
yes.
200,000 views, which is incredible.
I know. I started doing that with my very first book, Shoes for Me, that came out in 2011. Back when I had, the old Mac, and I was using, iMovie and just trying to piece it together. I thought, oh, I'll make a little teaser video for the book. And then I kind of decided I was going to do that for every book, which was probably a good idea for marketing. But then I end up, it ends up being, okay, now I have to do four of them this year. But I do make little teaser book trailers for my book. So yeah, if you want a little taste of what the book is before you buy it or check it out at a library, it's amazing that I did not know that it had 200,000 views.
No, this is actually the whole story. I hope these are sanctioned by the publisher.
That's amazing, actually. It's amazing that, you know, some people worry that if, you know, the whole reading of a book is out on the internet, that that's going to impact sales in a negative way. But I find that book every year has a big surge for St. Patrick's Day, even though it might be available online. You know, people see it, the adorable illustrations by Emma Randall on that one.
I've heard that a lot of leprechauns buy that book to share with their families so they'll know how to avoid the traps.
Yes. Well, go ahead.
No, I was going to say that there's a similar story with TED. Jane Cohen went, I think, to Chris Anderson and said, let's have the TED Talks on the internet for free.
Yes.
And he said, oh, no, people won't buy tickets. Well, try and get a ticket to TED. You know, the price of tickets went up. I'm a big favor of the videos because that makes you want to go out and have the book.
I mean in other industries too, like you said, in media. And then I'm a huge fan of the Dave Matthews Band, and that's how they grew their fan base, by letting people record their concerts and sharing them all for free without it being, you know, policing it for pirating. And they still allow that, and they're huge, you know, they've become this huge band. So anyway, I don't really have an issue with it. I know some publishers don't want, you know, the whole book in its entirety for copyright issues, and I get it. But I also think that if people love the book, they're gonna try to find a way to own it. So
let's love your octopuses.
Okay. So after I wrote the Cicada book, which, by the way, I wrote that really for myself. I was just fascinated by them. And I wrote it during the pandemic. I didn't think even that it would sell. And now it's doing really well, and it's won awards and things like that. Once that one was done and sort of about to be out in the world, my publisher, my editor said, I think we want to do another one very in the same format, you know, the rhyming verse with the facts sprinkled in. And she said, you know, what might you want to write about? And I immediately knew. I said, I want to write about octopuses. I'm fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by the fact that they're so they're so elusive that they're very hard for scientists to even study them. So I was a little worried about how am I going to find information. But there, of course, there's plenty of information out there. But just learning about them was so fun. So whenever I'm writing a story, especially nonfiction, but even with my fictional stories, I want to be interested myself. Otherwise, it's not going to be a good book, right? If I'm writing about something that doesn't interest me, I'm not caring. So when I have the opportunity to choose the topic, then I make sure it's something that I'm really excited about.
And they didn't say octopuses, yuck, who's going to buy your book?
No.
Good.
That's what I thought they were going to say about the cicadas. Yeah. I thought, what a weird insect. It's a lot of people are grossed out by cicadas. A lot of people, I don't know if you have, do you have cicadas where you live?
I haven't found any recently.
That's good.
Lucky for both of us, I'm a microbiologist and I'm retired.
Very cool. Well, I lived in California for about 17 years. I grew up in New Jersey. We had like gypsy moths and weird bugs, but no, I never saw a cicada. Moved out to California. When I moved to Virginia in 2014, we moved there in the summer, and one of my first experiences in my backyard was seeing this huge bug that was on its back. And of course, I assumed it was deceased. And I took a stick and I was videotaping it because I thought, oh my God, I can't wait to tell my husband this bug that was in our backyard. And I went to flick it with a stick just to like move it off my backyard. And of course, it wasn't dead, and it was very loud and made this really crazy buzzing, clicking sound that now I know all about, and flew right by my head. And I showed the video to my friend in California, and she said, you need to move back here immediately. It's not safe in Virginia. But that was sort of my first experience with cicadas. And then when the brood emerged in 2021, where it's like millions and billions of cicadas are everywhere. That was when I really got interested in it. But when I was writing it, I thought, who is going to want this story about this? Sort of felt localized. It felt kind of icky maybe for some people. So actually when I pitched octopuses, I thought, well, I don't think there's anything, I don't see anything gross about octopuses. They're just cool. They're, you know, they're sometimes described as alien. You know, people long ago thought they were sea monsters because they didn't see them very often, didn't understand them, didn't know they existed. So I felt like I was at least avoiding the ick factor with octopuses. And the next one that comes out next year is elephants. I think everyone can agree that elephants are not gross. Everybody loves elephants. So anyway, so that's that. I've already written that one. That one comes out next March. But the octopus book was, it was amazing. I was really inspired by, I don't know if you saw also during the pandemic, everybody was talking about and watching the Netflix documentary, My Octopus Teacher. If you haven't seen it, anyone out there, highly, highly recommend it. It's just a documentary about a guy who was sort of free diving in very cold water, I think off the coast of Australia, maybe, but very cold water. And he saw an octopus his first dive down and decided, I'm going to try to find that octopus again. And then it just follows this story. And I was so fascinated by the things that the octopus was doing. I was just researching octopuses on my own. And then, so then when I had the opportunity to pitch an animal to my editor, I thought, please, please let her say yes. I want to write about octopuses. So
I was going to say that octopuses have a mind of their own, but they have many minds of their own.
Actually. Oh yes. They have nine brains. And it's funny because of course they have a brain in their head, but then they also have in their eight arms there. It's not so much a singular brain like that would sit right here. It's just all of the nerves, and it's neurons just going all through so that's how then when they touch something, they can immediately, they know what it is. The one thing I would love to know that I don't know is if they touch different things, do you know what I mean? How that processes? I don't know, but if you want, I would love to read just the beginning of it.
I was just going to ask you.
Okay. So at first you can also just see the colors. It's amazing. Gorgeous.
That's kind of ironic because octopuses don't see colors, do they?
No, I don't think they do. And that's in here.
And octopuses, they, you know, if they could read books, they would love your book.
Thank you.
Read the first of it.
So, but I was just going to say they changed colors like crazy and textures and all that stuff. So underneath the ocean's waves, deep in coral reefs or caves, wedged in crevices or shells, a fascinating creature dwells. And then these little facts are about how they spend so much of their time hidden in dens, in holes, in coral. Some even make holes in the sand to hide. And they're usually alone and fiercely protect their homes. And of course, they have no backbone, and there are about 300 species of octopus. So after I gathered all my research, then I had to sort of decide what was going to make it in, which was also very hard to do.
I love the way that they've, I suppose it's the art director, I'm not sure, the way that they've juxtapositions the poetry with the back matter.
Yes.
It's not back matter, it's page matter.
That's right. So I do have books that have the back matter, and I think it was sort of my editor and I immediately said it would be really cool if we can have that peppered in as opposed to just reading, you know, because the facts are so relevant to each different page that it makes
and
sense.
More and more books are doing this now. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So the wolf eye, I think it's called the wolf eye octopus, is the smallest octopus, less than 1 inch long and weighing less than a quarter of an ounce. So you can barely even see it right here. And then this is the giant Pacific octopus, can grow up to 30 feet. So, yeah, it was such cool research. I even bought myself an octopus. You can see on my shelf up there. But what else would you like to know?
Not doing so well, though, the one on your shelf.
No, but he's just stuffed. He's okay.
Okay.
I've eaten octopus in the past, and after all my research, I don't think I could bring myself to eat octopus again. Just knowing that they basically are sentient and they dream and they have memories, and it just kind of would feel really weird. Although I will say, it is delicious. But knowing what I know,
I eat kosher, so I've never had octopus. So I'm like a little ahead of you in this category.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Okay. And I don't plan to eat them. Especially after reading your book. If I ever thought of eating octopus, no. They're curious. Wow, it's a great book. And I love your rhyme and the rhythm. It's splendid. Let's go back now and talk about Sue, because there's some pixie dust you want to share.
Oh, you know, when I go to school visits and things like that, you know, one of the biggest questions I get is, you know, wow, you have so many books. How do you get all your ideas? And my answer to that is I wish there was a pixie dust. I think that there are topics out there that have been done. I mean, look at how many octopus books are out there now. Some people think, well, there's not room for another octopus book, but if you come to it with your own style, your own way of telling that story, whether it's fictional or nonfiction, then there is room for that story. So I've sort of over the years trained my brain to always be thinking about the story. So when thinking about stories and where they come from. So sometimes I'll get an idea from a poster in the airport, or I'll hear someone say something and think, oh, that's a really cool description of that. Maybe I'll write about that, or that can be something that a character says in one of my books. So I, you know, obviously I also draw from my own childhood and my own kids and what they did. I used to do spying with my sister. We used to spy on my parents and never get any good information, but we would pretend like we got great information. And then we'd go meet in the laundry room. And that was our special like spy headquarters. And, you know, so I wrote a book called Beatrice Bly's Rules for Spies. And it was sort of, you know, we had a little saying that when my sister and I would meet in the laundry room, we would repeat this little sort of a mantra. I can't really remember exactly what it is, but I remember repeating that. So I thought, well, maybe there's a girl who has like rules about that, and you have to be a certain way and do certain things. So that kind of developed from, you know, an experience when I was a kid. You know, people say, oh, ballet, were you a ballerina? Or, oh, you write about science, are you a scientist? And I just tell kids, and I tell grownups too, that I just try to write about things that I'm interested in. And if I'm interested enough, I go learn about it. And then if I want to write about it, I'm sort of become a mini expert on it. Because I'm not a scientist, but science has always enthralled me. I've always been a curious person. As far as, you know, talking about cicadas, I have an insect expert kid scientist book. I wrote a book called The Bug Book many years ago. So I used to be that, like, not, I don't want to say weird kid, but when other girls were picking flowers, I was collecting bugs in a little, like, it was called a bug eye that had a magnifying glass at the top. I don't know what they're called now, but I've seen them out still. So I would collect all kinds of bugs and just watch them and observe them. And so part of the pixie dust is observing the world around you and knowing when something clicks enough that you could try to write a story about it. But I've written lots and lots and lots of stories that have not become books also. So, you know, you don't know what's going to hit. You just have to try to write the best story you can and hope for the best. So
take us back. You know, I have my theory, Sue,
okay,
that the people who write for 5-year-olds are essentially 5-year-olds. Mm-hmm. Are you a 5-year-old?
Maybe 6 or 7. you know, it is funny though. I I try to come at my books with that sense of wonder that kids have, you know, and not something that Sue Fleece is interesting, you know, finds interesting now, but would a kid find that interesting if they were just learning about it? So that's sometimes how I weed out things that I either include or don't include in my stories. Like, come across a fact that I thought, wow, that is so interesting and unique. That one has to go in. Whereas, well, you know, this one can probably go to the wayside because I don't think a kid, even though I might find it interesting as an adult. So I try to put that lens on when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. But I do try to write from a place of just curiosity, like a kid would.
Okay, but that's my theory, is that people who spend so much time and effort writing books for 6-year-olds have some issue with their inner 6-year-old. That's just my theory. You can
like a negative issue?
No, something that they had to like when I write, I'm trying to speak to my 5-year-old. When I was 5, then something in my family changed. I don't know what it was. But I'm writing to that 5-year-old Mel. And so, of course, I think everybody is. Not the 5-year-old Mel, but this is my theory. Don't answer me now. You can think about it.
No. I think there's something to that because, you know, I mean, I grew up in, I was 19, the 70s and the 80s. And, you know, I did have a lot of interest in sort of the outdoors and insects and things like that. Whereas, you know, so maybe that is why I gravitated towards putting females doing science in a lot of my books or inventing things. Because maybe, you know, I didn't see a lot of that around me. You know, my mom, she went to college and she was an accountant. And my dad was in like pharmaceutical sales. So it wasn't like, you know, I was seeing a mom in a too much of a traditional role. She did stay home with us. But, you know, there was the other kids. I think I was a little bit different than the other kids, maybe.
Sue, I'm going to have you back on the show. you can cogitate a bit. Okay. But here's the thing, you see, because I read about you. You had a career. You had serious careers. You were a corporate, a copywriter. And then you decided to become a children's writer. And as a children's writer, it's, at least at the beginning, you don't make any money. You just spend money.
In the beginning?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
It is funny. I have a little joke when I visit schools. I say, you know, I have a little true or false quiz. And one of the things I say was when I became a published author, I bought this car and I show a picture of a red Lamborghini. And I say, raise your hand if you think it's true. Raise your hand if you think it's false. Of course, everybody says false. And I said, you didn't see me pull up to your school parking lot in my red Lambo. And they all turn their heads to like look wherever the school parking lot is. And I said, of course, I did not. I don't drive a Lamborghini. And I said, and even with, you know, 50 some odd books out, I still can't afford a Lamborghini. I did have serious, I mean, it was a career in sort of marketing, PR, event planning.
Let's go back because we're all over the place, as I hoped and expected we would be. Let's do a little, keep me on track, Mel.
Keep me on track.
Absolutely.
I can ramble.
Okay. No, rambling is fun. That's how we come up with ideas, isn't it? So take us back. You were a rambunctious 6-year-old collecting things. You and Charles Darwin, and you grew up, and then what happened?
Well, I actually, from a young age, I thought I wanted to be an artist. I loved painting and drawing, and I took art lessons up the street from a woman who taught. She was an artist, and she taught art from her house. And I basically learned all the different things. Perspective. I did line drawings. I did charcoal, paint, acrylic, oil paint, that kind of thing. And in high school, I took all the art classes I could take. In college, I declared art as my major. But always on the side and from a young age, I also wrote a lot of poetry. When I was very little, it was a lot of rhyming poetry. And as I got older, it was more, you know, I tried to be, you know, literary and write these poems, you know, about big world things. But it never really dawned on me that I could translate that into being a writer or being even a children's book writer. About halfway through college, I decided that I was a pretty good artist, but I didn't think I was going to be able to sort of make it on the outside. Just doing what I wanted to do was like renderings. Like if you gave me a picture of something, I could draw it just like the picture, that kind of thing. And I thought, is there a need for that? I mean, computer animation was just starting, digital art, everything. And I thought, wow, I use a pencil and paper, you know, I'm just going to be extinct. I joke sometimes that if I had stuck with it, maybe I would have been the first employee at Pixar, because if I had been on that wave anyway. I digress. But so I, at some point in college, I decided that I really loved writing. I mean, creative writing was my favorite class. I did not major in journalism or English or anything like that. A lot of people think, oh, you're an author. You clearly, that was your path. It was not. I took those classes and I enjoyed those classes. And so my first job out of college, I just wanted to make sure that there was a lot of writing involved. And that's kind of how I steered my career, was just, how am I going to get to do a lot of writing in my job? And the other parts of the job, whatever. But as long as I can do writing. And then eventually it became that I thought, well, maybe I can just get a job just writing. And that's how I sort of transferred into copywriting, specifically and, you know, exclusively.
It says you wrote for Disney, did you?
I did, but it was like a work for hire. It was a book. Yeah.
So what?
Yeah. My editor for my book, Tons of Trucks, which is like a novelty lift the flap, touch and feel book. She left Houghton Mifflin and went to Disney, and we just had kept in touch. And she said, do you have any interest in writing a book about princesses for Disney? And I thought, sure. And so, yeah, that was it was like 5-minute stories, the Disney's Palace Pets. So I did write for Disney, and believe it or not, that gets like a lot of play at school visits. You know, the kids hear that and they think I wrote, you know, Tangled or something, which I did not.
And so what was your, how did you break in? How did you realize that, hey, you know, I can be a picture book author?
So when I sort of was, when my kids, well, my one kid before I had my second child, when he was really little, he was very obsessed with outer space. I mean, we're talking 2-3 years old. He was, you know, memorizing all the moons of Saturn and things like that. And I thought, well, maybe I'll just write him a little story about a kid that goes to space. It wasn't very good. I probably should have never sent it out on submission, but I did. But while I was writing that, I had the really good fortune of living across the street, and I was not working at the time because I had just had him, and I was getting ready to go back.
Well, this is spectacular, because you and 5 million other mothers and fathers who write for their children, but they don't have a career afterwards, you see, and you did. So
yeah,
what happened?
I mean, I didn't know I was going to have a career. I mean, I went and saw, I had the good fortune of living across the street from the children's librarian at our local public library when I lived in Mountain View, California. Mm-hmm. And shout out to Bobby. She was the one that told me, you know, oh, here are some websites, here are some things you can do to sort of learn about the industry. And she was the first one to say, it's very hard to break in. And I think I just didn't want to hear that part. So I was like, okay, great. I've got all my resources. And then kind of serendipitously, my tennis partner, I was playing a lot of tennis, and my tennis partner, Nadine, said, I found this class that sounded interesting at the local college. It was just called, like Children's Book Writing 101. And I just thought, oh, well, that's so interesting, because I'm just now kind of getting interested in this. And I remember we were about to go to, it was like an all day Saturday class, and she got sick and couldn't go. And then I thought, am I going to go to this all day class by myself? And I did. I was like, well, I paid for it already. I'm going to go to the class. And throughout the class, an author, a children's book author, was teaching the class, and she said, you know, after this class, probably about half of you are going to say, this is not for me. The other half are going to think about forming a critique group, like a writer's group. Then half of that writer's group is going to stick with writing. And then half of that writer's group might give up after, you know, 10 rejections. And I was doing the math as she's doing, I'm looking around the class and counting.
Nobody left.
Well, it kind of was like two people left. And I thought, why can't I be one of those two people? So I kind of left that class with a fire in my belly. Like, I've got to at least give this a good try, you know? So yeah, I sent out the terrible space manuscript and it never got picked up. But while I was waiting for answers on that one, I just started writing more stories. So by the time I met Jennifer, I had one story, Shoes for Me, which was very close to going through. And then Jennifer was like, I love all your picture books. I had written a young adult novel, but only about, it wasn't complete. But she said, I love that too. But even if you don't ever finish that, which I never did, I never wanted to finish it. She said, I love all your picture books, so I'll rep you for that. So yeah. So, but even then it was, I don't think I went back to work doing some copywriting because, as you say, one book, first of all, I sold the book, but it didn't come out for 2 years. So it wasn't like I was just going to sit around. So I did some different kinds of writing in between until it finally picked up enough that I felt like I could focus on this full time.
And talk me through your, because you are one of the authors who, and I like you for this, who plays between the nonfiction and the fiction. Mm-hmm. A few words about this.
When I first started writing, I sort of defined myself as a fiction writer. I looked at these nonfiction books and thought, wow, I don't know how these authors do it. They're making these topics seem so interesting. I just thought, well, I'm not going to probably do that. My first sort of accidental nonfiction book was a little golden book called Robots, Robots Everywhere, where I had just written sort of about, you know, all the different kinds of, you know, fun robots and things that they sound like and, you know, beep up and blink and they do this. And my editor said, I really love that, a little golden book. She said, I really love this, but I want all the robots in the book to either be real robots or ones that are being developed in the world. And I thought, oh, I had to get rid of half of the book. I mean, it's already a short book.
You had to kill a lot of robots.
I had to kill a lot of darlings, yes. And so I did a ton of research on robots because I was like, well, I don't know enough about all the robots that are being developed or what have you. So I ended up doing a lot of research. And it wasn't even until later that I realized that was probably my first sort of nonfiction story. But I did realize in that moment that it was possible. So I'm like, well, maybe I do have a nonfiction book in me. I don't know. You know, I just sort of left it at that. And I think it was much later that I realized that, well, I don't have to write a nonfiction book where it's heavy paragraphs about, you know, I said, oh, I can still use my rhyming and make it fun. And so I guess that was my way in, was my writing style. And even you can see on my top shelf, Flash and Gleam, Light in Our World, that was probably one of the first real true nonfiction books. But if you read just the poem, it's just about light. It's not really telling you facts, but the illustrations are, you know, when one spread is about, you know, 4th of July, but it doesn't say 4th of July is a holiday, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just a long poem. And then the back, it takes place in different parts of the world. And then the back has back matter. So it is a nonfiction book, but I sort of told it in the Sue Fleece way, whereas like I want it to rhyme and I want it to be spare and sound like how light is so light and everywhere. Now I do both almost equally. Which kind of is crazy to me because I just never thought I would be calling myself a nonfiction writer.
At the beginning, though, you alluded to the fact that it's all about the story. So if the story is fiction, if it's nonfiction, if it's somewhere in between.
Yes.
In my mind, that's perfectly fine. And I must say that when I read, like, when I read your lovely octopus book, I had an oy vey minute, because I was a scientist for 30 years, no, more than 30 years. And I look at that and I say, oy vey, so much, you know what oy vey means. You're Irish, but you know what it means. And I say, if not, you can ask Jennifer. And I say, so much, and you're not an octopologist. And how much work has to go into that for you? And I wouldn't want to write nonfiction. It's so much work, you know. Just get an idea, you know. First day out for a tooth fairy sounds marvelous. So, why do you have this penchant?
It is funny because, again, I would agree that there are some books that are definitely more research intensive, but especially with nonfiction, you have to get it right, you know. But I will tell you that I probably did almost as much research for Beauty and the Beaker, because I wanted her to discover a biofuel, and I needed it to be from some substance.
But Sue, you see, this is the beauty of Beauty and the Beaker. For me, you know, people are going to be angry with me now, but what can you do? You know, there's the people who are orthodox nonfiction. You're not allowed to do anything that wasn't done. You're not allowed to put words into the mouths of anybody, even if it's a leprechaun, even if it's a real leprechaun, even if you have the leprechaun on tape. It has to be all kosher, all documented, all whatever. But like for me, I love this. I love when you take a fractured fairy tale and put science inside. Hey, it's wonderful. Why not? Why not? There's no law against it.
Yes. To be fair, I could have just fudged all the science in it. I could have just made it up because it is a fictional story.
That's what I would do, but you're more religious than I am.
I felt like I needed to be, if I'm going to talk about a biofuel that I know exists, then I'm just going to sound like I was lazy about my research. So even though somebody might pick this up and say, oh, that looks really cute. I've had, you know, which book was it? The Princess and the Petri Dish. She grows a chocolate flavored pea. So I did research on growing peas, and how would you actually somehow create a new hybrid pea? So I did research on hybrid plants, and I tried to use scientific terms. Some of them get cut by the editor because they're too sciencey. They're too big of a word for a picture book. But, you know, I have her splicing and, you know, doing things and putting them on a tray and using them. So I try to be true to this. If I'm going to put science in something, I try to be true to the science. I probably could get away with not doing that. But for some reason, it's like I have an instinct to at least try to make it as accurate as I can.
And that's wonderful. I mean, do you wish that you were a scientist?
Say again?
Do you wish that you were a scientist? You have this envy of people like me who were scientists who wanted to be children authors?
Well, I have a good friend who was a scientist. Her husband is a scientist. I consulted with them on this a little bit, but she is now the children's librarian at my local elementary school. And she's like, she goes, for her, it was science and books growing up. And so she's still following a passion. I don't think I would have the patience for all the experimentation and the, you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess I have a lot of patience because writing children's books and the waiting and it has a different kind of patience.
You have the patience because you have the passion.
Yeah. And I love science, but I think I found the right path for me. Which I get to dabble in a lot of different topics.
It's a wonderful adventure that you have, and so successful. Like, do you realize, like, the odds of becoming a traditionally published author, less than 1 in 1,000, and you have more than 50 books. So we're running out of time, but you have one of two possibilities. Either you're going to sing a song for me, or you're going to give some really good advice that you never gave anybody else for the
Oh,
people
gosh.
watching and listening? Because there's something that you know that other people don't.
Oh my goodness. I mean, I would the advice I guess I would say is there are a lot of really good writers out there. I think that if you stick with it, I mean, it doesn't sound like authentic advice because everybody says, oh, don't give up. But I just know that there are a lot of really good writers that are very close that just decide this isn't going to happen for me. And I feel like if they just kept writing new stories while the other ones are being rejected or waiting for answers for the other one, that they're going to find that one story that finds a home eventually. I mean, I do feel like I was have more luck and live this charmed life that I finally got my foot in the door. But there were definitely moments where I thought, well, maybe I'll become a veterinarian instead. This might not work out for me. What else do I love? I love animals, and I just kind of stuck with it. And I think it was my husband came home one day when we used to have to get the rejections from the paper mail, and he could tell the self-addressed stamped envelope, and he knew what that was. And he just looked at me and he said, like, kind of sympathetically, how much longer do you think you're gonna do this? And because he felt bad for me with all the rejections. And I just looked at him and kind of said, until I sell something, of course. And so I kind of just, you have to sort of steel yourself to know that there's just going to be a lot of rejection along the way. And it's part of the journey. I just had a painful rejection a couple of weeks ago that I thought was, it went all the way to acquisitions and then didn't go through. And so even as a multi-published author, we still get rejected. And so, half of it is talent, half of it is timing, right? So if you give up, you might have just barely missed your window of timing. It could have been the next, 3 months. So I don't know. I feel like that's better than singing for you because.
I lied to you because you're going to sing in a minute anyway.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
There's another thing, and this comes true in almost every interview. Okay, there's luck and there's talent, and there's also study. At some stage, and you talked about this, and let's just go back for a second because it's so important. You wrote a manuscript that wasn't good enough for your child. You thought it was good enough. You sent it out on query. And then at some stage, you had the good sense to realize that you had to study. So, how did you study?
Well, and I am still doing this. I still take classes. I still listen to other authors. One of the great things about going to these writing conferences is hearing other people's, not just their story or their path, but hearing their process. I have definitely tried out a bunch of different things. Like, oh, I have a I saw one author speak and she said, oh, I bought myself an hourglass. So every morning for an hour, I write until the sand goes down. And I mean, I don't do that every day, but I've tried that. I do that occasionally. So I am always open to new ways. And yes, I go to the library, I do all that, but just hearing.
At the beginning, Sue, did you join SCBWI? Did you join
Oh,
Petition Street?
yes. So in the very beginning, that librarian I told you about, she said, this is an organization that you might want to look into. She also gave me a bunch of websites. And then I also, from her, I think she gave me the idea to get the book, The Children's Writers and Illustrators Market. So, and she said, just get it. It has all the publishers, all of what they're looking for, whether they take agented or unagented manuscripts. And then I would go to conferences and target the sessions run by editors who were at houses that were closed to unagented submissions, because often at the end of the talk, they'll say, if you attended this, th my talk, I'm open to seeing your manuscript, even if you don't have an agent for the next 3 months or whatever it is. So I kind of, went in a lot of different ways. Even when I met my agent Jennifer, the editor that I talked with, I knew that she had left her publisher and I had her email. So I reached out to her and I said, hey, while you're in between places, would you critique some of my manuscripts? So then, I made inroads with editors that way too, because some they're always moving around. So, you know, not to say you have to be sneaky, but you have to be creative.
It's what I call being a luck burglar. You have to be a bit of a luck burglar.
Oh, I love that.
You knock on the door, and if nobody answers, you check the doorknob a little bit, and this is a wonderful. One of the great things about you, Sue, is you're so candid,
for better or for worse.
And I would love to have you on again in a half a year or so, when your 100th book comes out. Maybe you can be my 250th interview. I don't know. we didn't talk about your process with poetry and your wonderful rhythm. And I want to talk to you about, we've run out of time. I want two things. I'd like you to sing a little bit because I know you love to sing. What would you like to sing?
Oh my goodness. I don't know. This is a lot of pressure. Let's see. I was just watching the Oscars last night. I'm just Ken. Anywhere else I'd be a 10. Okay. That's as much as I'm going to sing for you.
Wow, you can really sing.
I don't know. I'm very rusty.
6 months. I want you back in 6 months. We'll do a duet. Okay. We'll practice.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Sue, so I want you to wave again your brand new book, The Octopus
Octopus
Acrobatics, and read another a double spread and show it to us.
Okay.
And thanks so much for being you.
This is a fun one. Where octopuses mimic their enemies. Will it fight or flee or trick? It must make decisions quick. Sensing an approaching threat, it stays as still as it can get. Mimicking the enemy, it passes by them easily or squirts its ink and jets away and lives to see another day. So yeah, they're pretty amazing. So it's imitating sea snakes here. And then here it's shooting its ink out, and the ink sometimes confuses or even poisons a predator, and then it can get away. So.
Well, they've been with us for quite a long time.
Yes.
Octopuses.
Yes, they're amazing. And I hope that everybody just comes away from, whether it's my book or seeing their first octopus or learning about octopuses, about how amazing these creatures really are, and that they should be respected and revered and not feared.
So, Sue Fleece, this has been wonderful. Everybody run out and buy some of your books that are coming out. And it was a real pleasure to speak to you. And we're going to go out and come back and kick everybody else out and just have a short tete-a-tete. Bye, everybody. Sue Fleece,
thank you so much for having me. Thank you for having me.
I have to remind everybody that I'm Mel Rosenberg, the host of the Children's Literature Channel for the New Books Network, and I've been here with the multi award-winning author, Sue Fleece. Bye, everybody. Come back to
soon. Thank you. Bye-bye.